Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mergers and acquisitions are usually signs of strength, indicators there is money to be made by joining forces. Two big home builders announced a deal this morning. Now all they need to take care of is that making money part. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargill.com/creates. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It is the 8th of April, a fine day, I think, to talk about real estate. There was a very big deal in the housing industry today. Pulte Homes out of Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, is buying Dallas-based Centex. It's a $1.3 billion acquisition that will make Pulte one of the biggest home builders in this country. It's paying 38% more than Centex was worth at the close of trading yesterday, which would tell you that Pulte thinks the purchase can make it some money in the long run. But in the short run, there is still the reality of the American housing market circa 2009. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Most of the news from the housing market has been dismal lately. Nigel Gault is chief U.S. economist for IHS Global Insight. He says cheap foreclosed homes continue to flood the market.
We had a one-month uptick in the new home sales, but the basic picture for new homes has been clearly worse.
So why would Pulte Homes want to increase its exposure and pay top dollar for rival Centex? Well, first, it'll save money, $350 million a year, according to the companies. Bernie Markstein is senior economist with the National Association of Home Builders. He says mergers lower costs.
You may not need as many back office people. Of course, what we're have at this point is fewer sales and you're doing less construction.
When construction does pick up, the company will be poised to grow. It'll have $3.4 billion on hand. Gary Painter directs research at the USC Lusk Center for Real Estate. He says cash is a good thing to have right now.
Because there's not the same sort of credit available that there obviously used to be, you'll put them in position to acquire inventory of land for the long term.
And acquiring land in the right places for the right buyers will make all the difference, Painter says.
Where the growth in terms of the population is going to be from immigrant children becoming first-time home buyers. And then you're going to see the baby boomers who are starting to cross into retirement age.
Here, the merged company is sitting pretty. It'll be strong in starter homes and retirement communities, and it'll have lots of land in Texas and North Carolina, growing Sun Belt states with plenty of immigrants and retirees. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The problems home builders like Pulte and Centex are having are of a piece with the larger economic picture, of course. As people lose their jobs and property values decline, governments can't collect enough to taxes to cover costs. That leads to budget gaps, which in turn leads to cities and counties having to borrow more, which they do by issuing what are called municipal bonds. This week, Moody's, the credit rating company, gave those local governments a poke in the eye. It gave the whole municipal bond sector, that is all those cities and counties, a negative outlook. From New York Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
A government's bond rating is a bit like your credit score. The lower it goes, the more expensive it is to borrow money. Moody's warning this week suggests it could downgrade the bond ratings of cities, counties, and school districts. Matt Fabian of Municipal Market Advisors says it's about time.
The factors that they note are, high unemployment, a poor stock market, a poor housing market. These are all things that have very obviously been affecting credits. So, that it's taken them so long, I think, is more of a surprise than the action itself.
The action did catch Raina Farrellis off guard. She's deputy manager of San Mateo County in California. Her county lost $150 million from the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, but held on to its high credit rating. Now Farless says the rating's up for review.
We're certainly in a situation where we would never be in a position to default. So why they would issue a negative outlook on all jurisdictions is a bit of a surprise.
This isn't the first time Moody's has released this kind of blanket warning. Ben Watkins directs the state of Florida's Division of Bond Finance. He says Moody's issued a similar negative outlook for all states about a year ago. He says that sends a signal to investors that these governments are under stress, but it's a big leap from stress to default.
The default rate on state and local governments' plain municipal bonds are virtually nil. It virtually never happens.
That's because government officials will bend over backwards to avoid it. Even when Orange County filed for bankruptcy in the 90s, bondholders got their money back. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Oil closed just shy of $50 a barrel today. Good, perhaps, for consumers. Not so promising for research into renewable energy. Last month, Shell froze its investments into solar, wind, and hydrogen power. BP has been scaling back its research into alternatives since 2007. But at a conference in Washington today, many investors said they still see a sunny future for clean tech. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll explains.
At the Carbon TradeX conference in Washington, the talk among attendees is less about if they should invest in renewable energy and more when.
I think the overriding question is all about time.
That's James Cameron from the floor of the conference. He's one of the founders of Climate Change Capital, an investment house dealing in clean tech. Cameron says investors want more direction on the policy front before throwing money into research.
You could have a brilliant business strategy that is dependent upon a particular outcome of the legislation and find that you run out of money before the rules are made effective.
The Obama administration's stimulus plan dedicates about $80 billion to clean tech. That's a great promise for the future renewable energy market. But the economy's put the brakes on everything. Applied Materials announced this week that its big solar panel deal of almost $2 billion is actually much smaller, only $250 million. Scale-downs like that will probably continue until the economy improves.
That's going to affect investment across the board. It's not just renewables, and it's not just carbon abatement programs, it's everything.
Ken Medlock is an energy fellow at Rice University. He says although companies would prefer the economy picked up, this slowdown allows them to take a breath and think about energy development moving forward. So it's kind of good for companies, and he says it could actually be good for the environment, too.
When demand is down, we reduce carbon emissions de facto because we're consuming less carbon-based fuel.
Less travel, less production, less pollution. I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more up than down. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Life insurance companies had an all right day in the markets today. All it took was a mention in this morning's Wall Street Journal that the Treasury Department plans to give them bailout money. It's what's left over in the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the original bank bailout. Life insurers are big investors in real estate and corporate bonds, so they have taken a hit as the economy goes under. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Life insurers act a lot like banks. They take your premiums, invest them, and give you or your heirs some of the returns years later. For some, like Robert Hunter at the Consumer Federation of America, insurance companies have made too many big promises to their customers.
For example, they've in variable annuities, they promised the amount of your insurance won't fall below certain amounts, and of course now they don't have the assets they thought they would to back that up.
Those hit the hardest asked for federal help months ago. But insurers are regulated by states, making them ineligible for federal bailout money. Some insurance companies have taken over federally chartered savings and loans just so they can be treated as a federal bank and therefore eligible for TARP. Robert Leighton at the Brookings Institution says federal oversight is long overdue.
It's been anachronistic that we've had a state system for insurance. They've been the exception. There's no other system of financial institutions that doesn't have federal regulation.
But could consumers lose confidence in insurance companies that get in line for government help? Robert Hunter says if his company applied, he'd check on the penalties for early withdrawal of his money.
I don't think I'd be putting big hunks of cash into insurance companies that were applying for TARP.
Industry sources, though, say the federal backstop will give customers the assurance their life insurance investments are as safe as their bank deposits. The Treasury announcement on an insurance bailout is expected within days. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The government board that's in charge of keeping an eye on the TARP is out with its latest report, and the verdict is mixed at best. The panel says it's still not sure Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has a long-term strategy for saving the banks, despite the trillions of taxpayer dollars that are on the line. Commentator Robert Reich says it is past time to start holding people accountable.
Tim Geithner says he might fire the heads of big banks that are being bailed out, just as he disposed of Rick Wagoner, the former CEO of General Motors. And before Wagoner, the old heads of AIG, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac. Geithner's tough talk is designed to reassure a public that's lost all faith in the bank bailout. At the rate the bailout money is being spent, Geithner will have to go back to Congress to ask for more. And just as he did with the pending auto bailout, he'll have to claim a scalp or two to prove he means business. But that may not be enough to convince the public. After we've sent Wall Street $4 trillion so far, including $590 billion in direct federal spending, as well as trillions in loans and guarantees, the street still isn't lending much to Main Street. There's been a small uptick in lending to big businesses lately, but small businesses continue to be squeezed. Big banks are still hoarding cash, still paying their executives princely sums, still using corporate jets, and entertaining themselves at fancy resorts. It would have been more efficient to bypass Wall Street altogether and lend the $4 trillion directly to Main Street. So maybe Geithner really should fire many of them. Explain to me, for example, why Kenneth Lewis is still the CEO of Bank of America after blowing the purchase of Merrill Lynch. Or why Citigroup's Vikram Pandit is worth $38.2 million he collected last year, after Citigroup so far has sucked up $52 billion taxpayer dollars. I mean, we taxpayers now own a big chunk of these companies. The least we can demand is accountability. Yes, I know, Wall Street needs all the talent it can find, and we don't want government bureaucrats running our banks. But we do need people who understand that when they take billions of dollars of public money, they have public responsibilities to forego big paychecks, to clean up their balance sheets, and to make the financial system work for the rest of us. If they don't get that, they should join the millions of other Americans who have lost their jobs since the downturn started.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Write to us with your comments. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Mind you, this isn't official yet, but the Obama girls are apparently very close to getting their new puppy. The president has said it would arrive in the spring, and when it actually does get to the White House, I hope he's ready for a trip or two to the pet store, because new puppies need a lot, or at least we have come to think that they need a lot, and we fork over billions of dollars for our pets every year because of that mindset. Michael Schaefer writes about the pet industry in his new book, One Nation Under Dog. Schaefer himself became a first-time dog owner not too long ago when he got Murphy.
He's an oddly small St. Bernard. He's only 100 pounds. They're supposed to be like 180 or something. And I remember we were driving out there to go look at him, and we were making all these rules for ourselves. Like, you know, we're never going to be the people who spend a whole bunch of money on veterinary care, and we're never going to be the people who do this, and we're never going to be the people who buy that. And then, you know, I don't need to tell you that he came home and all of a sudden all that logic and that idea that there's some clear difference between crazy, over-pampering people and normal people, that idea went right out the window.
You didn't even make it home, right? I mean, you stopped at a pet store on the way home and you're out the door for $200 or something, right?
It all seemed really logical. I mean, he needed a bed and we were going to crate train him, so he needed a cage. And what struck me when the very first time we stopped at the pet store was that he was completely filthy. You know, he had dreadlocks and he stank to high heaven. And we went up to the grooming area of the store and said, you know, hey, he needs everything. And they said, well, you should have made an appointment a couple of weeks ago.
Well, forget grooming. I mean, 25 years ago, the big choice when you had a dog was, is it Alpo or Calcan, wet or dry? And then Right. You were pretty much done.
Right. And that world has, I mean, a lot of what I read about in my book is about how the way we treat our pets is like this funhouse mirror reflection of the changes in our human society. So A generation ago, most of us humans all shopped at Safeway or some store like it. And nowadays, the food market has changed so that some of us are shopping at Whole Foods, some of us are at Walmart, some of us are going off the grid and going to the organic farmers market. And pretty much the same thing has happened in pet food, where there are still big house brand generics that lots of people buy. And at the top of the line, there is this sort of never-ending competition to be more nutritious, more natural, more holistic, whatever that means, than the next person.
And it's tough to take this seriously, but by the same token, for a lot of people, it is a very serious thing, the relationship that they have with the pets and how much they're willing to invest.
Right. And a lot of people who have pets, you know, you see this very intense relationship. One theory, which I subscribe to, is that the boom in pets, sort of starting from the late 60s or 70s on, just as divorce increased, just as people started moving to further flung neighborhoods away from tight-knit communities, just as all of these kind of bowling alone phenomena took hold, and people were less connected to one another. And one thing some people did with great benefit to themselves was have their pets fill in some of the gap.
Obviously, this is a value judgment that each individual person has to make, but is this sustainable, this investment in our pets? I mean, it's billions and billions of dollars a year.
According to the Trade Association for the Pet Industry, it was $17 billion in, I think, 1994, and it's $45 billion in 2008. Didn't take a hit in the 2001 recession, seems to be resisting this recession pretty well, too. A lot of this spending of time and money and energy and emotion on pets has to do with this promotion that we've given them from man's best friend to what the marketing people call a fur baby. And, you know, once you've gotten that promotion, I think it's awfully hard to get a demotion just because of the economy. People who have a choice, at least, are going to scrimp and save on themselves before cutting off the dog's supply of organic kibble or anything like that.
One Nation Underdog is the name of Michael Schaefer's new book. Michael, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, what tiny towns in Sweden are counting on to boost their economies.
Of course, will we have some Iraqis moving down to us? We will be very, very grateful.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street might have ended even better today if not for revelations of a very grim mood last time Fed policymakers met. That put a damper on the Dow. Still managed to close higher 47 points, though, 0.6%, 7837 the number. The NASDAQ bounced 29 points, 1.8%, finished at 1590. The S&P 500 recovered 9 points, not quite 1.2%, wrapped up trading at 825. The big home building merger we began with today got mixed reviews from investors. Centex saw the value of its stock climb almost 19%, but investors on the other side of that deal pushed shares in Pulte Homes down more than 10% today. We mentioned earlier it was a good day for life insurance companies. Here's how good. Stock in Hartford Financial got a boost of more than 13%. Prudential Financial shares owned a piece of the rally too, climbing almost 8%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Trusted Choice, over 10,000 independent insurance agencies nationwide, committed to treating customers as people, not policies, online at TrustedChoice.com. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for February. Director of the National Economic Council, Larry Summers, remarks on the state of the economy before the Economic Club of Washington. And the Masters Golf Tournament continues in Augusta, Georgia. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Ginnie Mae, the government National Mortgage Association, said today it issued a record $34.5 billion in mortgage-backed securities last month. Not bad for a far less well-known sibling. Ginnie comes from the same family as two other companies we've gotten to know pretty well over the past year. That would be Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're the government-backed companies that are behind a huge percentage of the mortgages in this country and who were, it should be said, recipients of a large chunk of bailout money last fall. So, how does Ginnie fit into that family? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Ganser has the answer in the latest installment of the Marketplace Decoder.
She's a bit of a wallflower, wears sensible shoes. She's more stable than her siblings, Fannie and Freddie, but was never as popular. And she has a face only an economist could love. Meet Ginnie Mae.
Okay, so maybe Ginnie Mae wouldn't make it as a contestant on the dating game, but economists do love her.
She has a good personality.
Alan Mendelowitz heads the Federal Housing Finance Board. He says a good personality boils down to one thing, stability. And Ginnie Mae has it in spades. She didn't go through the partial privatization process that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac did. Ginnie is part of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And Ginnie only deals with conventional mortgages issued by government agencies, like the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration. Ginnie guarantees these mortgages. And she's backed by her favorite uncle, Uncle Sam.
If you have a Ginnie Mae guarantee, you have a full faith and credit guarantee of the federal government.
Investors like Ginnie's conservative bent. 3 years ago, at the height of the subprime craziness, she guaranteed less than 5% of mortgage-backed securities. At the end of last year, that number zoomed up to 35%. She's now neck and neck with Fannie and Freddie. But Ginnie is still very picky about the loans she backs. She's now popular enough to be included in President Obama's foreclosure prevention plan. New White House guidelines for loan modifications will apply to most Ginnie-backed mortgages. And if there are foreclosures, investors in Ginnie's mortgage-backed securities still get paid. And guess who might be remade in Ginnie's image?
When folks talk about nationalizing Fannie and Freddie, it is quite possible that they'll be restructured in a way that would be very much like the Ginnie Mae structure.
And banking consultant Bert Ely says eventually Fannie and Freddie could be folded into Ginnie Mae. As an amped-up federal agency, Ginnie could forget about being a contestant. She'd be a player. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
When he was in Baghdad yesterday, the president promised the troops he met with that he would have them home by the end of 2011. Since the U.S. invasion 6 years ago, tens of thousands of Iraqis have left the country. A lot of them have stayed in the region. Those who can afford it, though, have gone to Europe, where Sweden has been the number one destination. Until last year, when the Swedes started getting tough, a fairly liberal asylum policy meant Iraqis had a good chance of being able to stay and of being able to join the labor pool. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Until recently, the city of Södertälje could brag that it had taken in more Iraqi refugees than the entire United States. So many Iraqis have come here lately that it would take years to find jobs for them all. But where Södertälje is overwhelmed, other cities in Sweden need workers. About a year ago, some of them started calling to ask if Södertälje's Iraqis might consider moving.
Our priority is to get these people into the job market and to start their own lives, whether it's here or in other cities.
Hovaida Abu Salem started a program called Roads to Sweden. It helps match Iraqis in Södertälje with new cities where they might have an easier time finding jobs. We met at the library in Södertälje one morning, where a couple of towns had come to make sales pitches to a room full of Iraqis. It's a funny presentation, a PowerPoint infomercial that talks as much about the region's fishing and hiking as it does about job opportunities. Jonas Wilderström is one of the people trying to sell Iraqis on a small town in southern Sweden.
Of course, will we have some Iraqis moving down to us? We will be very, very grateful.
Because like many towns in Sweden, they've been losing people to larger cities for years.
The biggest problem, as you perhaps heard, we don't really know what they want from us.
He guesses the region will have about 30 job openings to fill the next year, including spots for 6 doctors. Now, that's potentially a big deal for these Iraqis because as a group, they're highly educated, and many worry about having to take jobs that are beneath them here. That's not to say they're all white-collar professionals. Abu Salem, who directs the program, says there are enough cities and jobs to go around.
There are cities that might just want doctors and engineers. But at the same time, there are cities that don't need any engineers. They need carpenters. They need ironsmiths.
I was curious to see how realistic her assessment was. So I went to the town of Mora, a smallish city in central Sweden. 11 Iraqis have moved here, including Ban Jamil, who's an architect, and her husband, Fayez Minas, who's a classical musician. They moved here a few months ago after they got tired of waiting to get into programs like language classes in Södertälje.
When we got the permission to stay in Sweden, I think we waited 4 months till we met with someone who will help us. We didn't do anything. We were just waiting.
They live in a cozy yellow house surrounded by woods that the city found for them.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was still.
Welcome.
Minas goes to Swedish classes, and he has an internship teaching music. Jamil plans to start taking language classes soon. Both of them spent most of their lives in Baghdad, and they miss the excitement of a big city. But they feel welcome here. They've joined a church, they've made Swedish friends, Minas plays concerts. And the town's trying to do its part with counseling and mentoring programs and by offering subsidies to local companies that hire refugees. Minas wants to take advantage of it all.
I just want to learn more because I will depend on myself to manage myself in the Sweden, that I can and I can select my life. I can move to the north, to the south, to the anywhere.
Despite his determination and the city's best efforts, that may be hard. The economy's making jobs hard to come by, even for Swedes, and Minas still hasn't managed to find one. In Mora, Sweden, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Elisa's story was produced for us with support from the International Reporting Project.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, with the Masters Golf Tournament getting underway tomorrow, one's thoughts turn to other springtime sporting events, like horse racing's Triple Crown. The Kentucky Derby is less than a month away, but a corporate bankruptcy filing may turn the Triple Crown into, I don't know, a twofer, I guess you'd call it. Magna Entertainment, the company that owns the Pimlico Racecourse in Maryland, where the Preakness is run, has filed for Chapter 11. Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley introduced a bill today seeking eminent domain or the authority to buy Pimlico outright, but it's a tough fight. Legislature adjourns Monday, and he's in competition against a developer who wants to turn the racetrack into a shopping center. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow gained 47.6%, closed at 7837. The Nasdaq rebounded 29 points, 1.8%, ending at 1590. The S&P 500 bumped up 9 points, just shy of 1.2%, closed at 825. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, and Jeff Peters engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, when global recession can be a growth opportunity.
In this phase of the recession, there's only one group that doesn't have a liquidity problem, and that's the mafia. It's a huge opportunity for them to take over businesses.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong.
New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.